This is Audible.
Infinite Jest, written by David Foster Wallace. He'd got quickly familiarized with Little Lisbon's networks of alleys and transoms and back trash lots, and its dwindling population of feral cats and dogs. The area was fertile in overhead clocks of banks and churches dictating movements. He carried his Browning X-444 serrated in its shoulder holster, strapped inside his one sock just above the spats of the formal footwear he'd taken off the same A-formal A-fair, LTD, sidewalk display as the tux's coat. His lighter was in a fluorescent zip-upable slash pocket. Quality trash bags were plentiful in dumpsters, and land barges stopped at lights. The James Principles of the Gifford Lectures, its razored-out receptacle heart, now quite a bit closer to empty than Lentz would be comfortable thinking about directly, he had in his hand tucked up under one formal arm. And the Chinese women scuttled, centipedishly abreast, their mammoth shopping bags held in a right hand and left, respective. So the bags were side by side between them. Lentz was closing the gap behind them, but gradually, and with no little nonchalant stealth, considering it was hard to walk stealthily when one couldn't feel one's feet, and when one's eyeglasses darkened automatically whenever one went under a street light, and then took their time lighting up again after, so that no less than two of Lentz's vital sensory street senses were disoriented. But he still managed both, stealth and nonchalance both. He had no clue how he really looked. Like many of the itinerant mad of Metro Boston, he tended to confuse a wide berth with invisibility. The shopping bags looked heavy and impressive, their weight making the Chinese women lean in slightly toward each other. Call it 22:14 hours and 10 minutes. The Chinese women and then Lance all passed a gray-faced woman squatting back between two dumpsters, her multiple skirts hiked up. Vehicles were packed bumper flush all along the curb, with myriad double parking also. The Chinese woman passed a man lined up at the curb with a toy bow and arrows. And when the glasses undarkened, Lentz could see him as well as he passed also. The guy wore a rat-colored suit and was shooting a suction cup arrow at the side of a four-lease building and then going up and drawing a miniature chalk circle on the brick around the arrow and then another circle around that arrow and etc. As in a... what's the word? The woman paid him no orientoid mind. The suit string tie was also brown in tone, unlike a rat's tail. His wall's chalk was more pinkish. One of the women said something high-pitched, like an exclamation to the other. Your monkey language's exclamatories have an explosive ricocheting sound to them, as in a component of boing to every word. A window up across the street was producing the Star-Spangled Banner all this time. The man had a string tie and fingerless little gloves, and he stepped back from the wall to examine his pink circles and almost collided with Lentz, and they both looked at each other and shook their heads, like, look at this poor son of an urban bitch I'm on the same street with. It was universally well known that your basic orientoid types carried their earthly sum total of personal wealth with them at all times, as in, on their person, while they scuttled around. The orientoid religion prohibited banks, and Lentz had seen mammoth, double-width, twine-handled shopping bags and too many tiny Chinese women's hands not to have deducted that the Chinese female species of Oriental used shopping bags to carry their personal wealth. He felt the energy required for the snatch and sprint increasing now with each stride, drawing nonchalantly closer, able now to distinguish different patterns in the clear, like plastic flags they wrapped their little hair in, the Chinese women. His heart rate speeded to a steady warming gallop. He began to feel his feet. Adrenaline about what would shortly occur dried his nose and helped his mouth stop moving around on his face. The frightful hog was not and never numb, and now it stirred in the snow pants slightly with excitement of wits and the thrill of the hunt. Far from cutting-edge surveillance, the shoe was on the other foot, The unwitting Oriental women had no idea who they were dealing with, behind them. No idea he was back there surveilling them and closing the nonchalant gap, stumbling only slightly after each streetlight's light. He was in total control of this situation, and they did not even know there was a situation. Bullseye! Lance straightened the mustache with one finger and gave a tiny little yellow brick road stutter skip of pure controlling glee, his adrenaline invisible for all to see. There were two ways of going, and les assassins de fauteuil roulant were prepared to pursue both these. Less better was the indirect route, surveillance and infiltrating the surviving associates of the entertainment's auteur, its actress and rumored performer, relatives, if necessary, taking them and subjecting them to technical interview, leading with hope to the original auteur's cartridge of the entertainment. This had risks and exposures and was held abeyant until the director route, to locate and secure a master copy of the entertainment on their own, had been exhausted. It was this way that thus, they were now still here, in the Antitoire shop of Cambridge, to, comment dit, be turning all the stones. The 14th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. The secret to sprinting in high heels, poor Tony Krause knew, was to run on one's toes, inclined way forward, with so much forward momentum that one stayed well up on her toes, and the heels never came into play. Evidently, the wretched creature behind him knew this trade secret, too. They careered up Prospect, the creature's clutching hand just millimeters away from the trailing boa. Poor Tony held the two purses together, tucked away against his side like a football in U.S. football. Pedestrians moved artfully aside, long practiced. Poor Tony saw the pedestrians' faces very clearly as his odor preceded him like a shock wave. A man in a car coat made a smell face and did a kind of artful Veronica to let the two of them career past. Poor Tony's breath came in great, ragged, stitchy gasps. He had not banked on victim pursuit. He felt the creature's hand grope for purchase on the remains of his boa. The Donegal cap flew off and was not mourned. The thing's own breathing was also ragged, but the obscenity she hurled still came from the diaphragm, with conviction and vigor. The other thing had impacted a pole with a meaty sound Tony had shuddered to hear. His own father had struck himself about the head and shoulders as he grieved for his symbolically dead son. The moment after the impact and the strap gave way, Tony was up on his toes and in full flight, not banking on pursuit from the other one, this black creature screaming and just off his tail. For the first couple blocks, the creature had shouted for help and to stop the bitch, and poor Tony, then with a decent lead, had countered by also yelling, help, and for God's sake, stop her, flummoxing any would-be citizens. An ancient trade device among Harvard Square crews. But now the black creature had closed to within millimeters, and now it had real hold of the boa as they careered, breathing at full speed on their toes, and Krause unlooped the thing from his neck with a flourish and sacrificed the boa to the thing. But the loathsome creature's hand came right back, clutching at the air just over his leather collar, its ragged breath in his ear, cursing him. Poor Tony grieved in mid-stride at the thought that the thing had doubtless just tossed the boa carelessly aside into the street or gutter. Their shoes' toes formed complex and variable rhythms on the pavement. Sometimes their footfalls were in sync, then they were not. The thing stayed agonizingly just behind. Bold print signs for fresh killed chicken and complete destruction flashed past. Antitoire Entertainment was just over two long north-south blocks distant. Krause and pursuer both J-ran through a gridlocked intersection. Poor Tony shouted, help and please. The hand and hissed breath just behind him was like one of those simply horrid dreams where something unimaginable is chasing you for kilometer after kilometer, and just before its talons close on the back of your collar, you wake up sitting bolt upright. except this horrid creature's clutching hand just behind him scenario went on and on. Storefront and curb and leaping pedestrians all melting together at the periphery due right. Etatois Entertainment's discreet back door was accessible by a parking alley that cut west off Prospect just before Broadway and went west to intersect a smaller and dumpster-lined north-south alley, one of whose dumpsters, in which poor Tony had occasionally slept when out late and short of train fare, was within underhand-toss distance of the Canadian Brothers' rear exit. Poor Tony, purses under arm and the other hand clamped tight to the wig, calculated that if he could get a reasonable lead on the creature, by the time they hit the smaller alley, the dumpsters would keep it from seeing just which, hopefully unlocked rear door, P.T. sought basic human kindly refuge behind. He feinted around a bodega's sidewalk fruit display and shot a quick look back, hoping the creature would crash itself ass over tea kettle into the stacked fruit. It did not. It was still right there, breathing. Its stutter step around two cardboard tiers of Cape cranberries was discouragingly deft. This thing had all too clearly chased persons before. Its breath had a ragged implacability about it. It was all too clearly in this for the long haul. It was no longer shouting stop or gutterish obscenities. Poor Tony's breaths felt flamish. It sounded as if he were weeping almost. He tried to shout help and could not. He hadn't the breath to spare. Black specks floated upward through his vision. Only certain of the street lamps worked. His heartbeat was zakung, zakung, zakung. Poor Tony hurtled a queerly placed cardboard display for something wheelchaired and heard the creature vaulted also and land lightly on its toes. Its uppers were not straps and could not dig like the fine Ogniers. Tony felt blood on his feet. The entrance to the parking alley west was between a tax preparer's and something else. It was right around here. Cross squinted. The black specks were tiny rings with opaque centers and floated upward through his sight like balloons, lazily. Poor Tony was post-seizure, infirm, not to mention withdrawn. His breath came in stitches and half-sobs. He could barely stay on his toes. He had not consumed food since before the library's men's room stall, which was how many days? He scanned the blurred storefronts ripping past. An elderly person went down with a noise as the creature stiff-armed him. Somewhere a rape whistle blew. The tax preparers had the odd storefront announcement. On parle le portugais ici. Its hand's finger knocked the rim of Tony's leather collar with each footfall until it moved up, and poor Tony could feel its fingers in the hair of the chignon he held clamped to his head with a hand. Poor Tony's father used to come home to 412 Mount Auburn Street, Watertown, at the completion of a long day of cesareans, and sit in a chair in the darkening kitchen, scratching at his head where his mask's green strings had dug into the head. Its doubtlessly luridly long-nailed fingers were twining for purchase in his wig's hair when they hit the preparers and Tony cut a sharp right, breaking a heel on the pivot but gaining several steps toward a lead as the creature's momentum carried it past the alley's recessed mouth. Kraus whimpered raggedly and flew west, up on his bloody toes, hearing his breath off both alley walls, negotiating broken glass and the homeless supine. Hearing it back behind him several steps, crying a tight, echoed, "Stop! Motherfucking stop!" with a supine person, Kraus vaulted, lifting a decayed head from the alley floor to counter with, "Go!" Having traced, through the strenuous technical interview of the sartorially eccentric craniofacial pain specialist, whom they had traced through the regrettably fatal technical interview of the young burglar,
300,
whose electrical surge tolerance proved considerably lower than that of his room's computer's machinery, having traced their best chances at a copy to the hapless Antitois establishment, it had taken the AFR then several days to find it there, the real entertainment. AFR's USA sales leader, Fortier, the son of a Glen Allman glassblower, had allowed none of the mirrors to be broken or dismantled. In all other respects, the search had been methodical and thorough. It was a neat search, and also orderly, with time taken. Because the viewer of the shop was visually dysfunctional, a consumer TP had been purchased, and set up for volunteer viewing in the room of storage off the shop's back room. Each cartridge of the shop's exhaustive shelves was sampled by a volunteer, then discarded in one of the huge metal coffres de main in the alley outside the shop's rear door. A detail had been assigned to roll the extinguished Antetoit brothers in construction plastic and place them in a room of storage off the back room. This was for hygienic purposes. A detail also had procured an oilskin window shade for the front door's glass. Also, some printed signs which read closed, Ropas, and Relanche. No person had knocked at the door after the first hours, thus. Quickly, on the first day, in a liquor box, which was damp and smelled, they had found an example of the rival FLQ's tactical street display cartridges, with its crudely stamped smiling face, and the Il nous faut plus qu'on poursuive le bonheur embossed upon it. And young Tussigny, with characteristic valor, volunteered to be rolled into the room of storage and strapped in order to verify this, and Fortier allowed this. Father drank the gesture of a toast at Tussigny, and promised to look after his aged father and fur traps. And Monsieur Fortier had embraced the young volunteer and kissed both his face's cheeks as he was rolled in, and fitted by Monsieur Bourguim with EEG wires, and strapped in before the viewer placed in the room of storage. Then the cartridge of the street display turned out to be blank. Void. And then another from this box, also wet, also blank. Two blanks. Dunk, d'accord. Fortier, philosophical, counseled against disappointment or damage from a frustration. He and Marat had counseled all along that the FLQ displays of the entertainment and the wheelchaired man were probably the hoax, instilling of terror only. The fact that the displays which featured wheelchairs, a smack to the testicles of AFR, this was ignored. AFR wanted only to repossess this copy of the entertainment. As well, chiefly, now to determine, could this copy of Duplessis itself be copied? This was the real objective. A master cartridge.
301.
Unlike the FLQ, Les Assassins des Fauteuils Roulants had no interest in blackmail or cartographic extortings for the convexity's return. Not in reconfiguration of ONAN, or even its charter's dissolution. The AFR were interested only in dealing the sort of testicular frappe to the underbelly of USA self-interests that would render Canada itself unwilling to face the USA retaliation for this. If AFR could secure, copy, and disseminate the entertainment, Quebec would not be so much allowed as required by Ottawa to secede, to face on its own the wrath of a neighbor struck down by its own inability to say non to fatal pleasures.
302.
Fortier bid the AFR methodically to continue the search. Younger volunteers were rolled into the room of storage on a rotating basis to sample each set of cartridges. Aside from some bickering over the Portuguese pornography, the rotation proceeded with valor and care. The plastic-wrapped cadavers began to swell, but the plastic maintained hygienic conditions adequately for viewing samples of the many cartridges in the room of storage. The search and inventory proceeded in a painstaking and slow fashion. Monsieur Fortier was required to absent himself for a period in the search's middle to help facilitate Southwest Ops, the infiltration of that relative of the auteur felt most strongly, according to Marat, to have knowledge or possession of a duplicable copy. There was reason to think Monsieur Duplessis had received his original copies from this relative, an athlete. Marat felt USBSS felt this person may have borne responsibility for the razzles and dazzles of Berkeley and Boston, USA. The American's field operative, jutting with prostheses, had been clinging to this person like a bad odor. The nation USA treated wheelchaired persons with the solicitude that the weak substitute for respect. As if he were a sickly child, Fortier. Buses knelt, smooth ramps flanked steps. Attendants pushed him aboard flights in full, solicitous view of those standing upon legs. Fortier owned detachable legs of flesh-tone polymer resins whose interior circuitry was responsive to large bundle neural stimuli from his stumps, which, with metal crutches, whose bracelets locked to his wrists, allowed a sort of swirling parody, a perambulation. But Fortier, he rarely wore the prostheses, not in USA, and never for public transit. He preferred the condescension, the pretense of institutional sensitivity to his right of the equal access. It hung the edge of his senses of purpose. Like all of them, Fortier was willing to sacrifice. The 14th of November, year of the Depend Adult Undergarment. After so long not caring, and then now the caring crashes back in and turns so easily into obsessive worry in sobriety. A few days before the debacle in which Don Gately got hurt, Joelle had begun to worry obsessively about her teeth. Smoking base cocaine eats teeth, corrodes teeth, attacks the enamel directly. Chandler Foss had explained all this to her at supper, showing her his corroded stumps. In her Latin cloth purse now, she carried a traveler's brush and expensive toothpaste, which alleged enamel revitalizers and anti-corrosives. Several of the Ennett House residents who'd hit bottom with the glass pipe had no teeth, or blackened and disintegrating teeth. The sight of Wade McDade's or Chandler Foss's teeth gave Joelle the fantods like nothing at meetings could. The toothpaste was only recently available over the counter and was a whole level of power and expense above standard smoker's polish. As she lies on her side beside Kate Gompert's empty bunk, her veils selvage tucked secure between pillow and jaw, and Charlotte Treat also asleep across the lit room, Joelle dreams that Don Gately, unhurt and Mid-South accented, is ministering to her teeth. He is bibbed in dental white, humming softly to himself, his big hands deft as he plucks instruments from the gleaming chairside tray. Her chair is dental and canted back, yielding her face up to him, her legs shut tight and stretching up and out before her. Dr. Don's eyes are abstractly kind, concerned for her teeth, and his thick fingers, as he inserts things to hold her open, are gloveless and taste warm and clean. Even the light seems sterilely clean. There is no assistant. The dentist is solo, leaning in above her, humming absent chords as he probes. His head is massive and vaguely square. In the dream, she is concerned for her teeth and feels Gately shares her concern. She feels good that he makes no chit-chat, and probably doesn't know her name. There's very little eye contact. He is completely intent on her teeth. He is there to help, if possible, is his whole demeanor's message. His bib hangs by a necklace of tiny steel balls and could not be whiter, his head haloed with a strap and a polished metal disc attached to the strap just above his eyes, a tiny mirror of stainless steel, clean as the instrument's tray, and the dream's yielding and trustful quality of calm is undercut only by the view of her face in the halo's mirror. The disc, like a third eye in Gately's broad, clean forehead. Because she can see her face, convexly distorted and ravaged by years of cocaine and not caring. Her face, all bug eyes and sunken cheeks, lamp black smudges beneath the Popeyes. And as the dentist's warm, thick fingers gently draw her lips back, she looks up into his head's mirror at long rows of all canine teeth, tapered and sharp, with then more rows of canines behind them in reserve. The countless rows of the teeth are all sharp and strong and unblackened, but tinged at the tips with an odd kind of red, as of old blood, the teeth of a creature that carelessly tears at meat. These are teeth that have been up to things she hasn't known about, she tries to say around the fingers. The dentist hums, probing. In the dream, Joelle looks up into Don Gately's forehead's dental mirror's disc and is seized with a fear of her teeth, a terror. And as her spread mouth spreads farther to cry out in fear, all she can see in the little round mirror are endless red-stained rows of teeth leading back and away down a pitch-black pipe. And the image Of all these rows of teeth, and the disc blots out the big dentist's good face as he probes with a hook and says he assures her that these can be saved. Then, by the time Fortier was able to return to the dismantled shop, they had located a third cartridge emblazoned with the embossed smile and letters disclaiming need of happy pursuit, and after some regretful losses, they had secured and verified it. The Samizdat cartridge of entertainment, burglared from the death of Duplessis. Fortier was told the story. The cell's young Desjardins had been taking his turn in the viewing rotation, seated with young Tassigny in the room of storage during the hours of early morning, sampling the dregs of unshelved entertainments found in kitchen can waste bags in the same closet the Antetoile cadavers were swelling within. Desjardins had just moments before complained of the wasted time of cartridges scheduled for the Corfe demain. Tassigny, who had been in the room of storage with Desjardins, then was saved by the need to leave this room to change the bag of his partial colostomy. But, Marat reported, they had lost Desjardins, and the older and valued Joubé also, who rolled against orders into the room of storage to see why Desjardins had not been sending out the tapes for more tapes to sample. Both were lost. They had not lost more only because someone had thought to wake up Bruyme, whom Fortier had briefed with care on procedures for if the actual entertainment was found by this viewing. But two were lost. Joubé, the red-bearded workhorse, who loved pop wheelies, and young Desjardins, so filled with the idealism and so young as to be still feeling the phantom pains in his stumps. Rémy Marat reported that the two had been made comfortable since their loss, allowed to remain in the locked room of storage and view the entertainment again and again, silent behind the door except when the watch detail reported the hearing of cries of impatience at the player's rewinder to rewind. Marat reported they had declined to come out for water or food, or Joubé, who was diabetic, for his insulin. Monsieur Bruyme estimated that it would be a matter of hours now for Joubé, perhaps maybe one day or 2 days for Desjardins. Fortier had sadly said, "Bouf," and acceptingly shrugged. All knew the sacrifices that might have been required. All viewing details had taken their chances at random in the rotation of viewing. On Fortier's return, Marat delivered also the expected bad news of the finding of it. There was no need yet for high RPM hardware of duplication. The found copy was read-only.
303.
Philosophical, Fortier reminded the AFR that they did now encouragingly know the entertainment of such power did truly exist for themselves, and could thus gird their courage and fortitude for the more indirect task of forfeiting hopes of securing a master copy, and instead striving to secure the original master, the auteur's own cartridge, from which all read-only copies had, presumably, been copied. Thus, he said, now the more arduous and risky task of taking for technical interview known persons associated with the entertainment and locating the original maker's duplicable master copy. None of this would have been worthy of the risk had they not now determined, through the heroic sacrifices of Joubé and Desjardins, that the device for extending ONAN's self-destructing logic to its final conclusion lay within their arduous grasp. Fortier gave numerous orders. The platoon of AFR remained in the closed Antetoile entertainment shop, behind their lingual window shade. Surveillance on the hated FLQ's Bureau Central, in the poorly disciplined house on Alston's Rue de Brenner, this was suspended. The AFR personnel pulled in and relocated to this commandeered Inman Square shop, where Fortier and Marat and Monsieur Bruyme coordinated phases of activity in this next more arduous and indirect phase, and reviewed tactics also. The deceased auteur's colleagues and relations were under constant surveillance. Their concentration of place worked in the favor of this. An employee at the Academy of Tennis of Enfield had been recruited and joined the Canadian instructor and student already inside for closer work of surveillance. in the desert, the redoubtable Mademoiselle Luria P. was winning necessary confidences with her usual alacrity. An expensive source in the subject's former department of the MIT University had reported the entertainment's probable performer's last known employment, the small Cambridge radio station which Marat and Beausoleil had pronounced "oui," where she had donned the defacing veil of O.N. Aonite deformity. Attentions were to be focused on the cartridge's performer and on the Academy of Tennis of the Autour's estate. The fact that the players of the Academy were to play a provincially selected team from Quebec would have been easier to exploit had the AFR possessed a tennis player of talent and lower extremities. Inquiries into the composition and travel of the Quebecois team were underway from sources at home in Papineau. On the day of Fortier's return also, the performer's radio program's technical engineer of radio had been acquired in a public but low-risk operation, whose success had raised hopeful spirits for the acquisitions of more directly related persons to the entertainment in this next phase. This person of USA Radio had divulged all he professed to know under the mere descriptive threat of technical interview procedures. Marat, the best lay judge of Americans' veracity, which the cell possessed, believed the veracity of the engineer, but nevertheless a formal technical interview had proceeded, justified in order to verify. The young and eruption-studded person's report remained consistent 2 levels past average USA endurance, the only variance involving several curious claims that the Massachusetts Institute of Technology was defensive in bed. Today, Fortier himself and Marat, young Balbulus, R. Osovecki, all those with the better English, were thus now therefore making the rounds of all substance difficulty rehabilitation facilities in hospitals, psychiatric institutions, and demi-maison within a 25-kilometer radius. Procedures for expanding the radius of inquiry by factors of 2 and 3 had been pre-formulated, teams assembled, lines rehearsed. Joubé and then Desjardins had succumbed and been transported north by van, as well with the remains of the Antitoile remains. The USA student radio engineering person, the veracity of whose limited statements of the subject's whereabouts, Rahim had verified to within plus or minus 0.35 of assurance well before debriefing levels incompatible with physical existence, had been allowed several hours to recover, then had become of service as the AFR's first subject in field tests of the samizdat cartridge's motivational range. The room of storage again was utilized for this. They sat immobilized with some straps. The test subject had viewed the entertainment twice at gratis without the application of any motivational inquiry. For inquiry into the degree of motivation the cartridge will induce, Monsieur Brouillim had rolled himself blindfolded into the room of storage, holding an orthopedic saw, and informed the subject of the test that, as of beginning now, each subsequent reviewing of the entertainment now would have the price of 1 digit from the subject's extremities. And handed the subject the orthopedic saw in question also. Brouillim's explanation to Fortier was that thus a matrix could be created to compute the statistical relation between N, the number of times the subject replayed the entertainment, and T, the amount of time he took to decide and remove a digit for each subsequent N+1 viewing. The goal was to confirm with statistical assurance the subject's desire for viewing and reviewing as incapable of satiation. There could be no index of diminishing satisfaction, as in the econometrics of normal USA commodities. For the samizdat entertainment's allure to be macro-politically lethal, the 9th digit of extremities had to come off as quickly and willingly as the 2nd. Brouillim, personally he had some skepticism about this, but this was Brouillim's function in his role in the cell. Expertise in combination with skepticism de cœur. And then, naturally, also a wider range of field test subjects would then be required to verify that this subject's responses were not merely subjective and typical only of a certain sensibility of entertainment consumer. The bus window yielded a faint and ghostly reflection of Fortier, and, through that faint view, the lights of urban life outside the bus. Somerville, Massachusetts, USA's Phoenix House administrative person, had listened to Fortier's delivery with shows of great compassion, then explained with patience that they were unable to admit addicted persons for whom English was the secondary language. D'accord, though he was pretending disappointment. Fortier had been able to see the admitted addicts of Phoenix House holding a gathering in the room of living outside the office door. No person among them wore a veil of facial concealment. And so, c'est ça. Four small teams were at this moment rolling through the streets and small streets and alleys of the unpleasant district of the Antitois establishment for the purpose of acquiring additional subjects for Monsieur Bruyim for the time when the subjects' digits were expended. The subjects for suitability had to be passively undefended enough to be acquired publicly with quiet, yet not damaged in the brains or under the influence of the many of the district's intoxicant compounds. The AFR were highly trained in patience and to be disciplined. The southbound bus, empty, and, which he detested, fluorescently lit, climbed a thin hill off Winter Park, North Cambridge, heading for the squares Inman and Central. Fortier looks out at the lights passing. He can smell snow coming. It soon will snow. He sees in his imagination two-thirds of NNE's largest urban city inert, sybaratically entranced, staring, without bodily movement, home-bounded, fouling their divans and the chairs which may recline. He sees the district of businesses, towers of buildings and luxury apartments, striated as two of every three floors is darkened to lightless black, with here and there the vaguely blue flicker of expensive digital entertainment equipment flickering through darkened windows. He imagines Monsieur Tyne holding the hand, holding the pen, of President J. Gentle, as the ONANite president signs declaring war. He imagines teacups clinking thinly beneath trembling hands in the interior sanctums of Ottawa's Sanctum of Power. He adjusts his sport coat's lapel over his sweater, and smooths the wiry hair that tends to bulge unsmoothly around the bare spot. He watches the back of the bus driver's neck as the driver stares straight ahead. Sure enough, the Chinquette women had been strengthless and lightweight, flew aside like dolls, and their bags were indeed treasure-heavy, hard to heft. But as Lentz cut left down the north-south alley, he could hold the bags by their twine handles out slightly before him, so their weight's momentum kind of pulled him along. The cruciform alleys through the blocks between Central and Inman, in Little Lisbon, were a kind of second city. Lentz ran. His breath came easy, and he could feel himself from scalp to sole. Green, and green with red dumpsters lined both walls and made the going narrow. He vaulted two sitting figures in khaki sharing a can of Sterno on the alley floor. He glided through the foul air above them, untouched by it. The sounds behind him were his footfalls echo off dumpsters and fire escapes iron. His left hand ached nicely from holding both a bag's handle and his large print volume. A dumpster up ahead had been hitched to an EWD truck and just left to sit, probably quitting time. The Empire guys had an incredible union. In the recess of the hitch's bar, a small blue light flickered and died. This was a dozen dumpsters up ahead. Lentz slowed to a brisk walk. His topcoat had slipped slightly off one of his shoulders, but he had no free hand to fix it and wasn't going to take time to put a bag down. His left hand felt cramped. It was somewhere vague between 22:24 and 22:26 hours. The alley was dark as a pocket. A tiny crash off somewhere south down the network of alleys was actually poor Tony Krause rolling the steel waste barrel that tripped up Ruth Van Cleve. The tiny blue flame came on, hung still, flickered, moved, hung there, went back out. Its glow was dark blue against the back of the huge EWD truck. Empire trucks were unstrippable. Hitches were valuable, but locked down with a kryptonite device thing, you needed welding stuff to cut through. From the recess of the hitch, there were small sounds. When the lighter lit again, Lentz was almost on them. two boys on the hitch, and two squatting down by the hitch facing them, four of them, a fire escape's pull ladder distended like a tongue and hanging just above them. None of the boys was over, like, 12. They used an M fizzy bottle instead of a pipe, and the smell of burnt plastic hung mixed with the sick, sweet smell of overcarbonated rock. The boys were all small and slight, and either black or spick, greedily hunching over the flame. They looked ratty. Lance kept them in peripheral view as he strode briskly by, carrying his bags, spine straight and extruding dignified purpose. The lighter went out. The boys on the hitch eyed Lance's bags. The squatting boys turned their heads to look. Lance kept them in peripheral view. None of them wore watches. One of them wore a knit cap and watched steadily. He locked eyes with Lance's left eye, made a gun of his thin hand, pretended to draw a slow bead, like performing for the others. Lance walked by with urban dignity, like he both saw them and didn't. The smell was intense, but real local, of the rock and bottle. He had to veer out to miss the Empire truck's side mirror on its steel strut. He heard them say things as the truck's grill fell behind, an unkind laughter, and then something called out in a minority agnate he didn't know. He heard the lighter's flint. He thought to himself, assholes. He was looking for someplace empty and a bit more lit to go through the bags. And cleaner than this one north-south alley here, which smelled of ripe waste and rotting skin. He would separate the bag's valuables from the non-valuables and transfer the valuables to a single bag. He would fence the non-negotiable valuables in Little Lisbon and refill the receptacle in his medical dictionary and buy some attractiver shoes. The alley was devoid of cats and rodents both. He did not stop to reflect why. A rock or bit of brick, courtesy of the junior crack jockeys back there, landed behind him and skittered past and rang out against something, and someone cried out aloud. A sexless figure lying back against a maybe duffel bag or pack against a dumpster, its hand moving furiously in its groin, and its feet pointed out into the alley and turned out like a dead body's. Its shoes, two different shoes, its hair a clotted mass around its face, looking up over at Lance going past in the faint start of light from a broader alley's intersection ahead, chanting softly what Lance could hear as he stepped gingerly over the rot-smelling legs as, "Pretty, pretty, pretty." Lance whispered to himself, "Jesus, what a lot of fucked-up ass-eating fucking losers." Our cult burned money for fuel. As in, like, currency. We used ones. The semi-divine one advocated thrift. We'd bring them to him at the stove. There was one stove. We had to bring them to him on our knees with no part of our feet could touch the floor. He sat by the stove in our blankets and fed it ones. We got an extra slap if the currency was new, as in like crisp new. It was a cleansing. Somebody always played a drum. Our cult's divinely chosen leader drove a Rolls, in neutral. We pushed him wherever he was called to, like, be at. He never turned it on. The Rolls. I got all muscled up. And some of them, they made us slither on our bellies. We had to embrace our snake nature. It was a cleansing. As in like slithering. Serious slithering. They took wire and bound our arms and legs. At least your wire wasn't barbed. I finally felt too cleansed to stay. Meaning overpure. I can ID, totally. It was too much love somehow to take. I'm like feeling the identification all over. This is... Plus I was up to 3 bags a day at the end. And then our divinely chosen's love squads made us chop wood with our teeth when it got cold. As in like sub-zero wintertime. Yours let you keep your teeth? Only the ones for gnawing, see? Sheesh. Just the ones for gnawing. Rami Marat sat veiled and blanket-lapped in the much-crowded living room evening of this Ennett House drug and alcohol recovery house, the last demi-maison on his portion of the list for this day. The hills of Upper Enfield, they were de l'enfer of difficulty, but the demi-maison itself had a ramp. A person with authority was conducting interviews to fill some vacancies of recent time in the place's office. of which its locked door was visible from the sitting. Marat and others were invited to sit in the living room with a cup of unpleasant coffee. Urged to smoke if he liked, everyone else was smoking. The living room smelled like an ashtray, and its ceiling was yellow like the fingers of long smokers. Also, the living room evening resembled an anthill which had been stirred with a stick. It was too full of persons, all of them restless and loud. There were demi-maison patients viewing a cartridge of martial arts conflict, former patients and persons of the upper Enfield area cohabiting on the furniture, conversing. A damaged woman, also in a fauteuil de roulant, like Marat, slumped in utile next to the cartridge's viewer, while a male person of advanced pallor mimed the kicks and thrusts of martial arts at her motionless head, trying to force the woman to twitch or cry out. Also, a man without hands and feet trying to negotiate the stairway. Other persons, presumably addicted, waiting in the room to seek admittance to the recovery house. The room was loud and hot. Marat could hear a person who will seek admittance vomiting in the shrubberies just outside the window. Marat's chair was locked down next to a divan's arm and directly before a window. The window, one could wish it was open more than a crack, he felt. Upon the dull-colored carpet, a tormented-appearing man scuttling like the crab while two hooligans in leather played a cruel game of jumping over him. Persons reading cartoon books and painting the nails of their extremities. A tall-haired woman brought her foot to her mouth to blow upon her toes. Another young girl seemed to remove her eye from her head and place it in her mouth. No other in the room wore the veil of the Entertainment Performers Organization, UHID. The smell of the USA cigarettes permeated his veil and made Marat's eyes water, and he thought of vomiting also. Two additional windows were open, but the room lacked all air. During the time of his sitting, several persons approached Marat, but they would say to him only the whispers, "Pet the dogs," or "Make sure and pet the dogs." This idiomatic expression was not in Marat's knowledge of USA idiom. Also, one person approached of a face whose skin seemed that it was rotting away from him in some way, and asked him if he, Marat, was court-ordered. Marat was one of few persons not smoking. He noted that none of the room's persons appeared to regard the cheesecloth veil he wore over his face as unusual or curious or to be questioned. The old sport coat he wore over a turtleneck sweater of Desjardins made Marat more formally dressed than other of the applicants for treatment. Two of the in-house demi-maison current patients wore neckties, however. Marat kept pretending to sniff. He did not know why. He sat up next to a divan of false velour, at whose end beside him two women, who had sought previous treatment of addiction in religious cults, were meeting and speaking together of their unenjoyable existences when in cults. To whomever approached, Marat carefully recited the introductory lines he and Monsieur Fortier quickly had developed. "Good night. I am addicted and deformed. Seeking residential treatment for addiction, desperately." Persons' responses to his introductory lines were difficult to interpret. One of the older two men in neckties, who had approached, he had clapped a hand to his soft face's cheek and responded, "How extraordinarily nice for you," in which Marat could detect sarcasm. The two women of cult experience were inclined closely toward each other upon the divan. They touched each other's arms several times in a kind of excitement as they conversed. When they laughed in delight, they seemed to chew at the air. One's laughter involved also a snorting noise, a clatter, and two shrieks. These came from one end of the dining room and the demi-maison's floor plans, a large kitchen. The sounds were then followed by a roiling cloud of steam with repeated obscenities from unseen persons. A bald, large black man in a white cotton undershirt's laughing became coughing that would not cease. The two patients in neckties and the girl whose eye could be removed spoke together intensively, and also audibly at the end of one other divan. "But consider this quality of portability with respect to, say, a car. Is a car portable?" With respect to a car, it's more as though I'm portable.
They're portable when they're on one of them semis, where they got new cars stacked on, with prices in the windows, like a good couple dozen on them semis that swing all to fuck all over I-93, and make you think the cars are going to start falling out all over the road when you're wanting to try and pass.
The plump one, who had been ironic toward Marat, he was nodding. Or, say, too, with respect to a tow truck or wrecker, if you suffer a breakdown, one might be in a position to say that a deactivated car can be, quote, portable, but that with respect to a functional car, it is I who am portable. The girl's nod caused the particular eye to wheel queasily in the socket of it. I'll buy that day.
If we're jot and tiddling with all possible precision regarding portable, that is.
The other man continually rubbed at his shine of the shoes with a facial tissue, causing his necktie to touch the floor. These conversers formed this triad on an unevenly sloped divan of leather-colored plastic across the room, which was now more airless, yet from the roiling steam from the kitchen infiltrating. Directly facing Marat in a yellow chair across the wall by these conversers' divan, most directly across the living room from Marat, was an addicted man waiting for seeking treatment by admission. This one, he appeared to have several cigarettes burning at one time. He held a metal ashtray in his lap and jiggled the boot of his crossed leg with vigor. For Marat, it was not difficult to ignore the fact that the addicted man was glaring at him. He noted it, and did not understand because of what the man glared, but he was unconcerned. Marat was prepared to die violently at any time, which rendered him free to choose among emotions. USA's, BSS's, Monsieur Steepley had verified that USA's did not comprehend this or appreciate it. It was foreign to them. The veil allowed Marat the liberty of staring calmly back at the addicted man without the man's knowledge, which Marat found he enjoyed. Marat felt sick to his body from the smoky room's smoke. Marat had once, as a child with legs, bent himself over and overturned a decaying log in the forests of the Lac de Deux Montagnes region of his four-limbed childhood, before Le Côte du Prochain Train.
304.
The pallor of the things which had writhed and scuttled beneath the wet log was the pallor of this addicted man, who wore a square of the facial hair between lower lip and chin, and had also a needle run through the flesh of the top of an ear, which the needle, it glistened, and did not glisten rapidly in succession as it vibrated with the jiggle of the jiggling boot. Marat gazed at him calmly through the veil while rehearsing his prepared lines within his head. The more idiomatic would be that the needle jiggled sympathetically with the jiggle of the boot, which was dull black and square-heeled, the motorcycle boot of persons who did not own motorcycles but wore the boots of those who did. The addicted man rose slowly and carried the burning ashtray with him nearer to Marat, trying to kneel. His blue jeans of Levi number 501 were strangely torn in spots with tattered white strings which showed the pallor of the knees. The torn holes had the size and perimeter damage of holes that Marat recognized had been made by shotgun blasts of the high gauge. Marat was mentally memorizing every detail of all things for both his reports. The addicted man kneeling before him, he leaned in closer, trying to remove something he believed was on his lip. Close in, the expression that through the veil had appeared as glaring corrected itself. The expression was more truly that the man's eyes had the vacant intensity of those who have violently died. The man whispered, "You real?" Marat looked through the veil at his facial square. "Are you real?" Again the man whispered,
all the time leaning more and more in, slowly.
"You're real. I can tell, ain't you?" the man whispered. Quickly he looked behind him at the uproaring room before leaning once more in.
"Listen, then."
Marat kept his hands calmly in his lap, his machine pistol holstered securely to his right stump beneath the blanket. The whispering man's searching fingers were leaving small bits of filth on the lip.
"Is these poor fuckers?"
The man gestured slightly with indicating the room.
"Most of them ain't real. So watch your six.
Most of these fuckers are metal people.
I am Swiss, Murat experimentally said. It was the second of his lines of introduction.
Walking around, make you think they're alive.
The addicted man had the way, with subtleness of looking all around himself, which Murat associated with intelligence professionals. One of his eyes had an exploded vein within it.
But that's just a layer, he said.
He leaned in so far Murat could see pores through the veil.
There's a micro-thin layer of skin. But underneath, it's metal. Head's full of parts. Under an organic layer that's micro-thin.
The eyes of men violently dead were also the eye of a fish in a vendor's crushed ice, studying nothing. The man's smell suggested livestock on a hot day, a goatish, even through the smoke of the room. Trans-3-methyl-2-hexanoic acid was a material, Monsieur Bruyim had lectured to past times in long surveillances, a chemical material in the sweat of grave mental illness. Murat, he had no trouble timing his breath, so his exhalation matched the addicted man's, who leaned more in.
There's one way to tell, he said. Get right up close. Like right up flush next to.
You can hear a whirr.
Microfaint. This whirring. It's the processor's gears. It's their flaw. Machines always whirr. They're good. They can quiet down the whir.
I have no seeks.
But they can't. Cannot eliminate it.
I am Swiss, seeking residential treatment with desperation.
Not under no micro-thin tissue layer, they can't.
If the gaze were not vacant, the gaze would be grim, frightened. Murat distantly remembered the emotion fear.
Did you hear what she said? The ironic man on the divan laughed. Potable means drinkable. It's not even the same root. Did you hear what she said?
The man's breath, it smelled of trans-3-methyl acid as well.
I'm clawing you in, he whispered. They're there to fool you. The real ones of us are getting fooled. 99+% of the time.
The flesh of the knees through the holes in the blue jeans was the white of long death.
But you? I could tell you were real.
He indicated the veil.
No micro-thin layer. The metal ones, huh, have faces.
The smoke of his cigarette in the ashtray rose in a motion of corkscrewing.
Which this is why, feeling the lip, why the ones on the T... or in the street, they won't let you ride up close. Try it. They'll never let you ride up close. It's programming. They know to look scared and, like, offended and back away and move to another seat. The real advanced ones, they'll give you change, even. To let them back off. Try it. Get right up, like, this close.
Murat sat calmly behind the veil, feeling the veil move with the man's breath, waiting patiently to inhale. The women with experiences in cults had smelled the odor of the man's trans-3 odor and relocated farther away upon the divan. The man's face smiled with one knowing side only of his mouth, acknowledging their movement away. He was so close that the nose of him touched the veil when Murat finally inhaled. Murat was prepared for death in all forms. The smells were trans-3-methyl-2, and of digested cheese, and the under of an arm, from the facial skin. Murat ignored impulses to impale the eye sockets with one two-finger motion. The man had his hand to his ear in a mime of to listen closely. His smile disclosed what might have once been teeth.
Nothing, he smiled. I knew. Not a sound.
The Swiss, we are a quiet people, and reserved. In addition, I am deformed.
The man waved his cigarette with impatience.
Listen up. This is why... You're how come I was here. I only thought it was a habit. They can fool you.
He scrubbed at the lip of his mouth.
I'm here to tell you, listen. You ain't here.
I have emigrated from my native Swiss.
Still whispering.
You ain't here. These fuckers are metal. Us. Us that are real. There's not many. They're fooling us. We're all in one room, the real ones. One room, all the time. Everything's projected. They can do it with machines. They project to fool us. The pictures on the walls change, so as we think we're going places. Here and there, this and that. That's just they change the projections. It's all the same place all the time. They fool your mind with machines to think you're moving, eating, cooking up, doing this and that.
I have come desperately here.
The real world's one room. These so-called people, so-called...
With again the flourish.
Everybody you know. You've met them before, hundreds of times, with different faces. There's only 26 total. They play different characters that you think you know. They wear different faces with different pictures they project on the wall. You get me?
This recovery house was recommended highly.
You follow? Count. Coincidence? There's 26 here. Counting the one without feet on the stairs. Coincidence? Chance? This here's every machine that's played everybody you ever met. Are you hearing me? They fool us. They take the machines in the back room and they like...
The visible door of the locked office opened, and an addicted patient emerged with a person in authority holding a clipboard. The addicted patient limped and leaned far to a side, though was attractive in the blonde stereotype of the USA image culture.
Change them. The thin organic layers, all the different people you know, so-called. They're the same machines.
Physically challenged foreign person with unpronounceable name.
The authority called with the clipboard.
I am being indicated, Marat said, bending to release the clamps on his fatoy's wheels.
Why I'm in this projection. To clue you. So that now you know.
Marat manipulated the fatoy to the right with its trusty left wheel.
I must be excused to plead for treatment.
Get right up close.
Good night, over his left shoulder.
The inutile woman seemed to twitch slightly in her heavy fauteuil as he passed.
You only think you're going someplace,
the addicted man called, still one half kneeling. Marat rolled up to the person in authority as slowly as possible, hunched deep into the sport coat and pathetically tacking. With significance, the large and clipboarded woman seemed without phase at the veil of UHID Marat, extended a large hand in greeting which he made tremble.
Good night.
The insane-smelling man on the carpet called out after,
Make sure and pet the dogs!
Joelle used to like to get really high, and then clean. Now she was finding she just liked to clean. She dusted the top of the fiberboard dresser she and Nell Gunther shared. She dusted the oval top of the dresser's mirror frame, and cleaned off the mirror as best she could. She was using Kleenex and stale water from a glass by Kate Gompert's bed. She felt oddly averse to putting on socks and clogs and going down to the kitchen for real cleaning supplies. She could hear the noise of all the post-meeting nighttime residents and visitors and applicants down there. She could feel their voices in the floor. When the dental nightmare tore her upright awake, her mouth was open to scream out, but the scream was Nell G. down in the living room, whose laugh always sounds like she's being eviscerated. Nell preempted Joelle's own scream. Then Joelle cleaned.
Cleaning is maybe a form of meditation for addicts too new in recovery to sit still. The five-woman scarred-wood floor had so much grit all over, she could sweep a pile of grit together with just an unappliqued bumper sticker she'd won at BYP.
Then she could use damp Kleenex to get up most of the pile. She had only Kate G's little bedside lamp on, and she wasn't listening to any YYY tapes. Out of consideration for Charlotte Treat, who was unwell and missed her Saturday night lively meeting on Pat's okay and was now asleep, wearing a sleep mask but not her foam earplugs. Expandable foam earplugs were issued to every new Ennett resident for reasons the staff said would clarify for them real quick. But Joelle hated to wear them. They shut out exterior noise, but they made your head's pulse audible, and your breath sounded like someone in a spacesuit. And Charlotte Treat, Kate Gompert, April Cordelieu, and the former Amy Johnson had all felt the same way. April said the foam plugs made her brain itch. It had started with Orin and Candenza, the cleaning. When relations were strained, or she was seized with anxiety at the seriousness and possible impermanence of the thing in the Back Base co-op, the getting high and cleaning became an important exercise, like creative visualization, a preview of the discipline and order with which she could survive alone, if it came to that. She would get high and visualize herself solo in a dazzlingly clean space, every surface twinkling, every possession in place. She saw herself being able to pick, say, dropped popcorn up off the rug and ingest it with total confidence. An aura of steely independence surrounded her when she cleaned the co-op. Even with the little whimpers and anxious moans that exited her writhing mouth when she cleaned high. The place had been provided nearly gratis by Jim, who said so little to Joelle on their first several meetings that Orin kept having to reassure her that it wasn't disapproval. Himself was missing the part of the human brain that allowed for being aware enough of other people to disapprove of them, Orin had said. Or dislike. It was just how the mad stork was. Orin had referred to Jim as himself or the mad stork. Family nicknames, both of which gave Joelle the creeps even then. It had been Orin who introduced her to his father's films. The Work was then so obscure, not even local students of serious film knew the name. The reason Jim kept forming his own distribution companies was to ensure distribution. He didn't become notorious until after Joelle met him. By then, she was closer to Jim than Orin had ever been, part of which caused part of the strains that kept the Brownstone co-op so terribly clean. She'd barely thought consciously of any incandenzas for 4 years before Don Gately, who for some reason kept bringing them, bubbling, up to mind. They were the second saddest family Joelle'd ever seen. Orin felt Jim disliked him to the precise extent that Jim was even aware of him. Orin had spoken about his family at length, usually at night. On how no amount of punting success could erase the psychic stain of basic fatherly dislike, failure to be seen or acknowledged. Orin had no idea how banal and average his same-sex parent issues were. He'd felt they were some hideous, exceptional thing. Joelle had known her mother didn't much like her from the first time her own personal daddy'd told her he'd rather take Pokey to the pictures alone. Much of the stuff Orin said about his family was dull, gone stale from years of never daring to say it. He credited Joelle with some strange generosity for not screaming and fleeing the room when he revealed the banal stuff. Pokey had been Joelle's family nickname, though her mother'd never called her anything but Joelle. The Orin she knew first felt his mother was the family's pulse and center, a ray of light incarnate, with enough depth of love and open maternal concern to almost make up for a father who barely existed, parentally. Jim's internal life was to Orin a black hole, Orin said. His father's face, any room's fifth wall. Joelle had struggled to stay awake and attentive, listening, letting Orin get the stale stuff out. Orin had no idea what his father thought or felt about anything. He thought Jim wore the opaque, blank facial expression his mother in French sometimes jokingly called Le Masque. The man was so blankly and irretrievably hidden that Orin said he'd come to see him as, like, autistic, almost catatonic. Jim opened himself only to the mother. They all did, he said. She was there for them all, psychically. She was the family's light and pulse and the center that held tight. Joelle could yawn in bed without looking like she was yawning. The children's name for their mother was The Moms, as if there were more than one of her. His younger brother was a hopeless retard, Orin had said. Orin recalled the moms used to tell him she loved him about 100 times a day. It nearly made up for himself's blank stare. Orin's basic childhood memory of Jim had been of an expressionless stare from a great height. His mother had been really tall, too, for a girl. He'd said he'd found it secretly odd that none of the brothers were taller. His retarded brother was stunted to about the size of a fire hydrant, Orin reported. Joelle cleaned behind the filthy room's radiator as far as she could reach, being careful not to touch the radiator. Orin described his childhood's mother as his emotional son. Joelle remembered her own personal daddy's Uncle T.S., talking about how her own personal daddy'd thought his own mama hung the goddamn moon, he'd said. The radiators on Ennett House's female side stayed on at all times, 24/7/365. At first, Joelle had thought Mrs. Avril Incandenza's high-watt maternal love had maybe damaged Orin by bringing into sharper relief Jim's remote self-absorption, which would have looked, by comparison, like neglect or dislike. That it had maybe made Orin too emotionally dependent on his mother. Why else would he have been so traumatized when a younger brother had suddenly appeared, specially challenged from birth and in need of even more maternal attention than Orin? Orin, late one night on the co-op's futon, recalled to Joelle his skulking in and dragging a wastebasket over and inverting it next to his infant brother's special crib, holding a heavy box of Quaker Oats high above his head, preparing to brain the needy infant. Joelle had gotten an A- in developmental psych the semester before. And also dependent psychologically, Orin, it seemed, or even metaphysically. Orin said he'd grown up, first in a regular house in Weston and then at the academy in Enfield, grown up dividing the human world into those who were open, readable, trustworthy, versus those so closed and hidden that you had no clue what they thought of you, but could pretty damn well imagine it couldn't be anything all that marvelous, or else why hide it? Orin had recounted that he'd started to see himself getting closed and blank and hidden like that as a tennis player toward the end of his junior year, despite all the moms' frantic attempts to keep him from hiddenness. Joelle had thought of BU's Nickerson Fields' 30,000 voices openly roared endorsement, the sound rising with the punt to a kind of amniotic pulse of pure positive noise, versus tennis's staid and reserved applause. It had all been so easy to figure and see then, listening, loving Orin and feeling for him, poor little rich and prodigious boy. All this was before she came to know Jim and the work. Joelle scrubbed at the discolored square of fingerprints around the light switch until the wet Kleenex disintegrated into greebles. Never trust a man on the subject of his own parents. As tall and busso as a man might be on the outside, he nevertheless sees his parents from the perspective of a tiny child still, and will always. And the unhappier his childhood was, the more arrested will be his perspective on it. She's learned this through sheer experience. Greebles had been her own mother's word for the little bits of sleepy goo you got in your eyes' corners. Her own personal daddy called them eye boogers and used to get them out for her with the twisted corner of his hanky. Though it's not as if you could trust parents on the subject of their memory of their children, either. The cheap glass shade over the ceiling's light was black with interior grime and dead bugs. Some of the bugs looked like they might have been from long-extinct species. The loose grime alone filled half an empty carefree box. The more stubborn crud would take a scouring pad and ammonia. Joelle put the shade aside, for until she'd shot down to the kitchen to toss out different boxes of crud and wet Kleenex and grab some serious chore-type supplies from under the sink. Orin had said she was the third neat-nickest person he knew after his mom's and a former player he'd played with obsessive-compulsive disorder, a dual diagnosis with which the UHID membership was rife. But at the time, the import had missed her. At that time, it had never occurred to her that Orin's pull toward her could have had anything either pro or con to do with his mother. Her biggest worry was that Orin was pulled only by what she looked like, which her personal daddy'd warned her, the sweetest syrup draws the nastiest flies, so to watch out. Orin hadn't been anything like her own personal daddy. When Orin was out of the room, it had never seemed like a relief. When she was home, her own daddy never seemed to be out of the room for more than a few seconds.
Her mother said she hardly even tried to talk to him when his pokey was home.
He kind of trailed her around from room to room, kind of pathetically, talking batons and low pH chemistry. It was like when she exhaled, he inhaled, and vice versa. He was all through the house. He was real, present, at all times. His presence penetrated a room and outlasted him there. Orin's absence, whether for class or practice, emptied the co-op out. The place seemed vacuumed and buffed sterile before the cleaning even started when he went. She didn't feel lonely in the place without him, but she did feel alone. What alone was going to feel like, and she, no one's fool,
305,
was erecting fortifications real early into it. It was Orin, of course, who'd introduced them. He'd had this stubborn idea that himself would want to use her in the work. She was too pretty for somebody not to want to arrange, capture. Better himself than some weak-chinned academic. Joelle protested the whole idea. She had a brainy girl's discomfort about her own beauty and its effect on folks, a caution intensified by the repeated warnings of her personal daddy. Even more to the immediate point, her filmic interests lay behind the lens. She'd do the capturing, thank you very much. She wanted to make things, not appear in them. She had a student filmmaker's vague disdain for actors. Worse, Orin's idea's real project was developmentally obvious. He thought he could somehow get to his father through her. That he pictured himself having weighty, steeple-fingered conversations with the man. Joelle's appearance and performance, the subjects. A three-way bond. It made her real uneasy. She theorized that Orin unconsciously wished her to mediate between himself and himself, just as it sounded like his mother had. She was uneasy about the excited way Orin predicted that his father wouldn't be able to resist using her. She was extra uneasy about how Orin referred to his father as himself. It seemed painfully blatant, developmental arrest-wise. Plus, she felt, only a little less than she made it sound, on the futon at night protesting, she'd felt uneasy at the prospect of any sort of connection with a man who had hurt Orin so. A man so monstrously tall and cold and remotely hidden. Joelle heard a howl and a crash from the kitchen, followed by McDade's tubercular laugh. Twice Charlotte Treat sat up in sleep, listening with fever, and said in a flat-dead voice something that sounded for all the world like trances in which she did not breathe, and then fell back, out. Joelle was trying to pin down a queer, rancid cinnamon smell that came from the back of a closet stuffed with luggage. It was especially hard to clean when you weren't supposed to be allowed to touch any other resonant stuff. She might have known from the work. The man's work was amateurish, she'd seen, when Orin had had his brother, the unretarded one, lend him some of the Mad Stork's read-only copies. Was amateurish the right word? More like the work of a brilliant optician and technician who was an amateur at any kind of real communication. Technically gorgeous, the work, with lighting and angles planned out to the frame. But oddly hollow, empty, no sense of dramatic towardness, no narrative movement toward a real story, no emotional movement toward an audience. Like conversing with a prisoner through that plastic screen using phones, the upperclassman Molly Notkin had said of Incandenza's early oeuvre. Joelle thought them more like a very smart person conversing with himself. She thought of the significance of the moniker, himself. Cold. Prenuptial agreement of heaven and hell. Mordant. Sophisticated. Campy. Hip. Cynical. Technically mind-bending. But cold, amateurish, hidden, no risk of empathy with the Job-like protagonist, whom she felt like the audience was induced to regard like somebody sitting atop a dunk tank. The lampoons of inverted genres, archly funny and sometimes insightful, but with something provisional about them, like the finger exercises of someone promising who refused to really sit down and play something to test that promise. Even as an undergrad, Joelle'd been convinced that parodists were no better than camp followers in ironic masks. Satire is usually the work of people with nothing new themselves to say.
306.
The Medusa versus the Odalisque. Cold, elusive, inbent, hostile. The only feeling for the audience, one of contempt. The meta-audience in the film's theater presented as objects long before they turned to blind stone. But there had been flashes of something else. Even in the early Ura, before himself made the leap to narratively anti-confluential but unironic melodrama she helped prolong the arc of, where he dropped the technical fireworks and tried to make characters move, however inconclusively, and showed courage, abandoned everything he did well and willingly took the risk of appearing amateurish, which he had. But even in the early work, flashes of something, very hidden and quick, almost furtive. She noticed them only when alone, watching, without Orin and his rheostat's dimmer. The living room's lights up high, like she liked them. Liked to see herself and everything else in the room with the viewer. Orin liked to sit in the dark and enter